Welcome back. You're listening to Recuperate, sponsored by Lady Bird Childcare Centre. Now, this is my pièce de résistance. I am very pleased to have in the studio with me today Madeline Slavik, a published poet, author, photographer. Good evening.
Hello, Lucy. Hello, everyone.
Hello. It's great to have you here. And I know that I got you at very short notice. So I'm very pleased that you made the time. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Now, Madeline, I met you at the Greytown Arts Festival. Mm-hmm. I was just ambling along interviewing the tape artist, and up you popped with Simon Fleck, another local poet. And you were actually doing you were the guerrilla poets.
Right. We had an event called Free Delivery. And on that Saturday afternoon, we just handed out little pieces of paper with a poem on them and asked people, would you like a short white or a long blue? Because Simon and I happened to have one poem on a small piece of blue paper and a longer poem on a white piece of paper. So anyway, we had a lot of fun just handing them out. But there were about 10 of us around the streets handing them out and placing them in mannequins and on the Marilyn Monroe statue.
Yes,
and hedges and bicycle seats and dog collars and wherever we wanted. It was because we were an official event of the festival.
So Absolutely.
We felt like we had permission to take over the town.
And you had a really good response to that from people that you met and were handing poetry to?
Yeah, there was a couple of people who were saying, well, we were hoping we were going to get a poem. So they knew about it. And then we invited them to come to the reading in the town hall, which was a big crowd.
Yeah, that was a big crowd.
We were really lucky because we were going to be in the Village Art Shop, which helped to organize the event.
Yeah.
And Janie Knott was wonderful. She called me up a couple of days before and she says, you know, I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of people and my shop is not going to handle this.
No.
So I asked the library if we could have it there. And then the library moved into the town hall and we had the whole space there as you came. And it was
and it
great.
It looked awesome, didn't it?
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. And I'm glad you didn't try and cram all those people in the Village Art Shop. I think there would have been a St. John's ambulance incident, to be honest. But it was quite a coup, that, because you had a number of published poets there reading. And the theme of the whole festival was the last piece. And they were trying to pick poems from that. You must have been really pleased to have that number of poets and that number of people coming to watch poetry.
Everybody I invited said yes, pretty much. And Fiona Kidman even said yes and then had to pull out at the last minute. And she was very sad. I met her at an event a couple of years ago. And so everybody had said yes and really wanted to be there. And I think in the end there were 9 of us.
Yep.
It was a great day. And we kind of have gone from that. We have an event every month at the Greytown Hotel at the Top Pub. So on the second Monday of the month, if you feel like some poetry. And also, it doesn't have to be strictly poetry. It can be a piece of prose or a song or a limerick or a stand-up comic kind of piece or whatever. It's pretty open.
Awesome.
We meet at 7 o'clock at the Top Pub, and it's just very casual. Come along if you'd like and see you there.
Great. And that's something that's kicking off this in January, isn't it?
We've had a few meetings towards the end of 2012, and we're continuing. We may or may not change location, so keep that in mind. And I'll let Lucy know if we change it in the future, because we may want to move to Masterton, actually.
Rightio.
We haven't decided.
Because I'll keep people updated via my blog, and also you have a blog spot as well, which we'll come to in a minute.
Okay.
But talking about your poetry, Madeline, how would you characterise your work, if indeed you can? What's your thing?
Well, I'd like to say, actually, that I don't really see myself as only a poet.
No.
I really think poetry needs to be in service of something else. And in my life, I studied social work, and I worked at Oxfam for 17 years.
Right.
And I've done a lot of, you know, community NGO work, and usually I try to subtly introduce kind of social political justice themes into my work without being too heavy-handed.
Right, yep.
And as a photographer, my work is very different yet again. It's quite meditative and abstract and kind of painted effect.
Right.
I hope for that anyway. Or then another kind of group of photography is quite quirky, funky, maybe like the Harvey woman you've been mentioning a little bit, possibly in that vein.
Right, yep.
But
I've read some of your shorter pieces on your blog, which is right. And the blog's touching what I love. And you write every day, don't you?
Right.
Which is pretty awesome. I mean, I have my blog, and I'm lucky if I get something cranked out, usually about a paragraph once every 2 weeks. So I'm full of admiration
but
for your
some
productivity.
Of my blog entries may be three words only.
But that's the beauty of
poetry.
Yeah.
You can get away with these little
Little haikus, aren't they, in
right.
a way? Yeah. And you combine it with a photograph.
Right.
And is the photograph taken that day, or is that from a...
It's recent, usually. Sometimes I use a piece, something that I've had for a while that somehow comes back into my mind for some reason. And it's just what I'm thinking about that day.
Yeah.
I don't spend a lot of time on my blog, I have to say. I used to. I've been doing it every day for 2 years and 2 months.
Wow.
And so I used to spend a lot of time on it, and I would stare and just make sure. I was very nervous about publishing something every day because I'm a very slow writer.
Right.
And
right.
to take on that challenge was a crazy thing, really.
Yeah.
But I mean, so now I just kind of do it as a moment thing, and I release it, and it's fun. It's quite liberating to be able to just send it out there.
And they come across like that, actually. You know, there's a freshness about each of your entries because it's kind of short and snappy, but it makes you think at the same time. So that's what I found anyway when I've been reading them.
Well, thank you.
And I you know, you've bought some of your books in today that you're published in, and I'd love you to read a poem or several. But I wonder if you could kickstart us off with one of your pieces.
Well, I selected a few yesterday when you called me to come in, and I've been living in Hong Kong for 25 years, so I'm a newcomer to New Zealand, and I thought I would read some pieces that kind of represent different modes and moods of Hong Kong and mainland China.
Yeah.
So this is a piece that I wrote in 1997. So, oh, geez. Ooh, 16 years old. Is that right?
Yeah,
oh, my God. 16 years old.
I know.
Ago.
It's awful, isn't it, when you start doing the math?
And actually, the poem starts in 1989.
Right.
Because I moved to Hong Kong in 1988, just a few months before the huge Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing, which is a huge piece of my personal history and Hong Kong's history and China's history. Anyway, so this poem kind of starts off in rural China, goes to Beijing, and moves through a period of 8 years. It's called Things in Between. 1989, Huayong Village. I shower by a low wall next to the family walk. A small stool, cold water from a pail, a red plastic scoop. Upstairs, a mosquito net lace easily made romantic by magazine posters of Hong Kong movie stars taped to the wall. High wooden bed, creaky. 1991, Shaoxing. Men pedal boats with their feet under stone bridges and television station towers. I savor warmed yellow wine. One sip, I hear Lu Xun's verse. Another swallow, it's Deng Xiaoping. 1993, Beijing. Her wide streets hold everything. Her old narrow hutongs hold everything else. 1994, Yunnan Province. A middle-aged couple dance an excited waltz to Bananarama in a second-floor disco while miniskirt lipstick women wait to perform karaoke. Shy couples drink sodas slowly. I meet a young mustache man from the local cigarette factory with big polyester ankles swaying. I'm your Venus. I'm your fire of joy desire. 1995, Shenzhen Special Economic Zone. She is from Hong Kong. I can tell by her matching yellow sweatsuit and the powder pink pager clipped to her hip pocket. She is touring splendid China. All the sights in miniature, spitless. 1997, Huayong Village. Gone. A half circle of shined blue roof buildings stands instead. A different ancestor. I should have said that the poem begins and ends in the same village. So at the beginning, I'm showering by the family walk because I used to be in a relationship with a Chinese man for a long time, and So at the beginning, I'm showering, you know, using this scoop over the body in the bed with the magazine posters. Yeah. And then at the end, the village has been cleared, and it's been... it was cleared to build the nuclear power station at Daya Bay, which is servicing that region.
Yeah.
So they've sold it all for money, basically, a different ancestor.
Yes.
That's what it refers to.
Wow. And I think that kind of that transition from the rural to the urban and then going back to what was once rural and is now resolutely urban, it's that must have been quite... for you personally, you know, as living in that environment, quite a shock, you know, to see environments transform so utterly in that way.
Well, China and Hong Kong are incredibly fast-paced, fast-changing places. And if you return to the same location 2 years, 5 years, 10, 15, after 5, 10 years, you really virtually may not recognize where you are anymore, even if it's your hometown.
Wow.
The streets will be, you know, huge buildings, talking about huge buildings with thousands of people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I mean, I've heard that story so many times from friends who have returned to their home villages or hometowns, or my husband at that time when he went back to Hong Kong after being in the States where we met.
Yeah.
He just literally wouldn't recognize places.
Goodness me.
And he felt like such a, you know, foreigner in his own hometown.
So to move from an environment like that to rural New Zealand must be quite another kind of shock in a way.
Yeah, I often say I really feel like I've had several lives because I mean, as a child, I moved around a lot in different parts of the U.S. My mother's German. I have a sister who lives in Brazil who, you know, I've been there and I know that society somewhat. And, you know, I've been a social worker. I'm an artist, kind of. And now I'm in New Zealand. And, you know, in Hong Kong, I lived as... I don't want to say I was an expat because I hate that word.
Yeah.
But I did have to live that life sometimes. But then I very much knew the Chinese kind of thinking in a very natural way, being in that family.
Yeah.
And so now I live next to a cattle farm. And, you know, my family now doesn't eat meat.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I'm doing here sometimes, but I love it at the same time. People are great, and it's very refreshing.
Mm.
And where I lived most of my youth was New England,
right,
in the state of Maine, which is the most northern state next to the Canadian border.
Right.
And in some ways, it's a bit similar, not the same, but that freshness of air. And
yes, the big wide spaces.
The spaces, the relative cleanliness of water and air and all that.
Yeah.
And the goodness of people in general.
Yeah.
You know, that slight kind of truth.
Yeah. And there's a stability as well, I suppose, that, you know, at the moment that is not there in China in terms of, you know, the landscape continually shifting and changing here. Mm-hmm. I mean, things do change, but on a, you know, not on that kind of hyper level that they seem to do it to.
The wind is crazy.
Yeah.
The earthquake thing and, you know, different factors. And, you know, it's like the wind yesterday was very strange to me because it's kind of out of season and you somehow, I kind of remembered, oh, yeah. I'm on this island in the far corner, surrounded by all this water and all this wind. And
don't try and grow courgettes. That's my only tip to anyone. It's because the wind on New Year's Day just ripped them out of the ground. So I'm a grieving gardener at the moment. I think we'll go to another track from Ren Harview. And this is the title track from her album, Through the Night. I think I got the title of her album wrong the first instance, but this is Through the Night. And we'll come back, Madeline, and talk a little bit more and hear some more of your poems. I have Madeline Slavik here with me today. She is a published poet and author and kind of a world traveller by the sounds of what we've been hearing about your past lives in dynamic places like Hong Kong and China. And you originated from the States. Have you had opportunities to return much to the States during your travels? And If so, is much of your work kind of inspired by your American past or your Americanness, if I may call it that?
Well, of course, we are who we are.
Yep.
I don't go back to the States very much. I mean, I've chosen not to live there.
Yep.
So when I go back, it's really to see my family and certain friends or, you know, if somebody's getting married or whatnot.
Yep.
I went back. When did I go back? I went back November 2010, I think it was, and I took a train ride from Los Angeles to New Orleans with a couple of breaks. And I wrote a long kind of travel essay, photo piece.
Right.
And that was just published in an Australian journal.
Okay.
A few weeks ago. But I don't normally write directly
No.
about my American life or, you know, isms. But it's obviously there. I mean,
yeah.
I was born in the 60s and I'm the younger of several kids. And
right.
So they really grew up with the 60s music and mentality. And,
yeah.
And my parents are very much into social justice movements, also connected with the church, the very liberal church.
Right.
And they're continually leaving churches that aren't active enough
right.
because they don't believe in you know, that separation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm very much raised on Dylan and Woody Guthrie and Joan Baez and
yeah.
and such. So, I mean, that will always be part of me. But I several people have said to me that I'm more Chinese than they are.
Right, right. Okay.
And I don't always like to talk, even though I'm a writer. And
yeah.
But I don't often. I'm really tired of words sometimes, and I just, you know. So what I'm saying is, I don't know what I'm saying. I mean, I don't. I hope I don't fit into these categories. And I.
No, absolutely. No, I know where you're coming from, and I wasn't meaning to pigeonhole at all. And certainly, you know, just the breadth of your work would suggest that, you know, you are absorbing, and you are, you know. You are your art in a way, I'd suggest, if that doesn't sound too airy-fairy. But I'd love to hear another poem of yours just to get more of a flavour of your work.
Okay.
And I know that you've got one in front of you.
I do. I think I have this one memorised. This is a very different one from the one you heard before. This is a prose poem on, literally, it's on different kinds of fruit.
Right.
So it has some kind of tropical fruit like rambutan.
Mm.
Do you know rambutan?
No.
It's kind of like lychee.
Oh, okay. Yep.
But it has these very kind of hairy tentacles on its skin.
Right.
And so the poem refers to that. So
okay.
That's rambutan. And then durian, which is like jackfruit.
Yes.
Breadfruit. And then I think those are the kind of, well, papaya, mango, I think pomelo.
Oh, no.
Like a grapefruit.
Oh, okay.
It's like a bigger, less sour grapefruit. I prefer pomelos. I don't really like grapefruit.
Right.
So anyway, it's just kind of playful. But it also has a, in Hong Kong, there was a lot of poverty in Hong Kong in the, like, 1950s, 60s. There still is, actually.
Yep.
One out of seven people lives in poverty in
Hong
Kong. It's a huge divide between...
It's not a side of Hong Kong you see or
exactly.
hear about, is it?
Yeah. Yes, and because I used to work at Oxfam, you know, I'm very aware of these statistics all the time and the reality.
Yeah.
And forget about numbers. But in the 50s, 60s, where most of my friends grew up at that time, there really wasn't a lot of fruit to be had.
Right.
And so to have fruit for people in my age group is kind of a luxury.
Mm.
And so it's kind of speaking a little bit about that, although that's quite a hidden thing that you won't know necessarily in this poem, but that's where it was born.
Okay.
And it's set Hong Kong has a huge range, actually. As you said, you don't hear about these things because Hong Kong, most people will think of huge buildings, very dense population. But there are a lot of islands where you can go where there are no cars and it's really green. And there's a 100-kilometer trail across the mountains just before the border with China and beautiful treks, beautiful beaches. I mean, it's quite polluted in too.
Yeah.
But so you have this real mix of things going on all the time. Anyway. So this poem is untitled. It's maybe I wrote this poem about 10 years ago, so we're getting closer to the present.
Right, yeah.
We don't need to color the orange orange, and lemons don't grow sideways. But do all plums have the same kind of belly button? Because every rambutan has eyelashes that want wilderness delicious. Delicious us apple. Turn us red and gold all over grape veins, grapevines. Is there any fruit that doesn't get twisted, pesticided, their pickers picked out of profits? One, two cherries ring as they swing while big-to-bottom pears sit like fat Chinese gods. Or are they party cadres? We all know polywogs wallow in their papaya boat and jackfruit lump along the trunk like a tumor to be cut off. But what does so much watermelon red open? For to pry a pomelo head apart in the middle of autumn's rebellion reminds us that there is still some sweet justice left. We must eat it to make more.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
I was particularly, probably because I got a 3.5-year-old, I was particularly taken by the belly buttons on the plums.
Oh, really?
She's a great fan of plums.
And she said the same thing.
No, she hasn't, but it would be just the kind of thing that would appeal to her. So.
Okay. Yeah.
And I particularly that image kind of stuck with me there.
Cool.
So, I mean, your reading, your first poem is from a few years back, and that was from 10 years ago. What does your kind of working life look like at the moment? What are you working on personally at the moment?
Well, at the moment, I'm kind of working for... I'm writing for pay. I mean, I'm doing editing work and writing work. I have a few book projects on that. I'm a freelance editor during the day.
Yep.
But for my personal writing, I've gone a little bit into this kind of anecdotal story style.
Mm-hmm.
And my latest book is 50 of these short stories. These are all set in Hong Kong, and I kind of made this book as a little farewell when I left last year.
Right.
But I think I'll continue in this vein of just short kind of episodic pieces. I wanted to read you a current poem set in the Wairarapa, but I'm just not ready. I don't feel like the poems are finished yet.
Right.
I've really been... I just keep tinkering and tinkering and tinkering, and it still doesn't feel right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I struggled because last night I was saying, oh, it would really be nice to... And it's one of my little policies when I give a performance somewhere. I said, okay, I always read the poem that I've just written or that I'm working on. But I felt like for this, I just wasn't ready. I'm writing. I came last winter in May.
Mm-hmm.
Came just in time for the winter.
Great.
Yes, was,
you must have been thrilled with that.
And I
because it's hard the winter, I find.
It was okay. It's lovely having a fire.
That's
so,
true. Yeah,
you know that you can survive anything. But and I was taking some Maori lessons. And so one of the poems I wrote was mostly set in that classroom, and meeting people and hearing their stories and hearing about all the suicide that happens here. Frankly, it was because there had been a couple of suicides.
Yeah, I remember that period.
That period. And a couple of people knew the family. And then I ended the poem with, at the end of the lesson, we all walk out to our cars.
Right.
And my last line was something like, and the cars feel farther away. You know, just that kind of pitch black, really cold, and you're a woman walking alone to your car.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And then another poem I wrote is about all the kind of life and deaths of animals around, which I'm just not used to.
You know. Is it that living in a rural environment?
I live out on Norfolk Road.
Right.
Kind of out towards Mount Holdsworth area. And so it's a huge cattle farm. And, you know, we hear guns going off to shoot the animal. And you know, neighbors have sheep and horses and cows and whatnots. And I've never lived around all this. So just learning the names of a female horse after a certain age and the cow that has been desexed is called this. It's just a cow, okay?
Yeah.
It's just a cow.
We should get a rural handbook, I think, when we arrive. Right. It would help, eh?
That poem is certainly not done. Just kind of stories.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, that's great. And you're going to read us one from...
So I'll read another one from Hong Kong, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. It'd be lovely.
And as I was saying, I mean, Hong Kong is not just the urban metropolis. So this is about insects.
Right. Lovely.
And it's set on one of those small islands with few people and no cars. On the first night at my home on the Carless Island, we slept on a mat on the floor. I felt something at my hand, and somehow knew in the sleepy darkness that it was a centipede, red and orange and scaly. I leapt, flinging the 100 legs across the room, where they scurried along the base of the wall, never to be seen again, nor the mate. Another night, I woke to my face covered in ants, the whole home filled with the weak-winged things. The red and green beams in the ceiling were being eaten. Later, the bed perfect, mosquitoless, in its white net canopy. And a few minutes after we turn out the lights, the geckos come out to laugh. You have geckos here, right?
Yes, we do. Yes, yeah. I believe we do.
Well, they tend to come out when you turn off the lights at night.
Yeah.
there's that clucking.
I actually had the experience of seeing a tuatara on Matthew Soames Island. If you ever want to get up close and personal to something truly kind of prehistorically New Zealand, then at night time they come out. It was slightly bigger than a gecko and it scared the living daylights out of me.
Were you camping there?
Yeah, you can camp up there. There's a limited number of people that can go on the island, but it's a great experience. And particularly you can go and see the blue penguins when they come in.
That's the one right in the Wellington.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe it. And you look out at night and you're surrounded by all this incredible nature and this kind of abundance of rarity and look out across the harbour to see the city. It's quite an exciting experience. But thank you for that. I'm not a great fan of insects. I think you've kind of captured that quite well for me. Well, Madeline, it's been a real pleasure. I'm absolutely thrilled that you took the time to be here with me, and I will, if it's okay by you, I would like to make some links on my blog site to yours, and just get some traffic going that way, because you know you're here to stay, I hope, and we look forward to hearing your Wairarapa poems at some point. And
thanks. I will share them when I've finished them.
We'll have you back.
Okay. I'll let you know.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you, Lucy.
Thank you, and I think we'll go.